From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll tell you about Tall Pines, a conservation group working to preserve and protect natural farmland.
Maintaining these dairy farms and maintaining farming it's part of our culture here. We got to keep it.
Milwaukee historian John Gerda shares his experience homesteading in Wisconsin. Plus, we'll learn about Wisconsin's motorcycle racing scene and why a film about it took 17 years to complete.
It was a very intense crossroads for me as a filmmaker because almost immediately I knew I was going to start Angels of Dirt again in an Era 2 kind of approach and focus the film on the story of Charlotte Caines.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. There are more than 40 land trusts in Wisconsin. Their shared goal is to serve as environmental stewards by preserving natural spaces. One land trust, based in Waukesha County, called Tall Pines Conservancy, pays special attention to protecting farmland. Susan Buchanan recently retired after a 17-year tenure as Tall Pines' first executive director. She, along with seventh-generation dairy farmer Kyle Zwig, sat down with WUWM Susan Bentz to talk about the importance of preserving rural heritage and the work Tall Pines is doing for farmers.
Tall Pines is about preserving farming, that economy, those families who are we hopefully will continue, as you are, Kyle, to be living and working the land, but also at the same time doing as much as you can to protect the land that we share and the watersheds that are shared. Would that be accurate?
Yes. Actually, we also closed on another project, another farmland protection project, just last week, and that was the Manis Farm. It's very close to here in the town of Ashopin, 200 acres. Purchase of development rights and another family farm. I'm trying to remember how many generations that one is.
At least four.
So through purchase of development rights, you know, the family is able to maintain the next generation in farming. That's one way that can happen. Otherwise, farmers don't often have 401k programs or retirement, you know, so this helps with maintaining that legacy.
Kyle Zwig, I'm a seventh-generation dairy farmer in the town of Ashopin. From young on, grew up on the farm and just kind of fell in love with the lifestyle that my dad had as I slowly grew older and ended up, you know, enjoying a lot of the advancements in our business and just different things we did on our farm from a practice standpoint to improve and become more conservation-minded over time.
Where did that conservation thread start for your family?
It started from two areas. One was Tall Pines itself when I got involved in the early years. And then number two was from another local family that really supported me as a student and young adult. Kepke Farms or Kepke family that really made an impression on my younger years. So those two areas were the main like initiation points for conservation and how we kind of shaped our business.
Can you give an example on the conservation side?
Some rough examples are focusing on like soil health and minimizing soil erosion. We have a cropping practice called no-till where we're not doing any plowing or disturbance of the soil. So we're leaving the soil biology, just soil life intact from season to season while leaving residue on the surface to minimize erosion and surface runoff or phosphorus pollution. Mm-hmm. Those would be kind of two small examples. Another one would be cover cropping, which is planting a crop in the off season of your typical crops to keep something growing, which is essentially trying to imitate a prairie setting.
Are those practices that came along with your leadership of the farm? Was your dad already doing some of this stuff?
A lot of the practices, it's like, you know, farmers are peers. We have people we work with in the area that we learn from. And those practices kind of came 50% from local operators like Kepke's who pioneered no-till and a lot of conservation practices starting in the 80s, way before any other operators were doing it. Where they really learned it from and where my knowledge was refined was through the UW system and their agronomy and soil science departments, which I got to be a part of when I spent my 2 years there in their production ag programs.
We've got these shining examples of what you and other farmers are doing, the Kepkes and others, what Tall Pine's mission is. But how would you describe the landscape beyond what we can see from your kitchen windows?
From a local standpoint, let's say the western suburbs of Milwaukee, things have changed a lot, and not in a good way. There's a lot less of me now existing in Waukesha, Washington, and southern Dodge counties. The development, specifically in Waukesha County, and the loss of farmland has been incredible. And that's the main landscape thing you see physically when you drive around. At one time, Waukesha County was named Cow County USA because it had the highest density of dairy cattle in the state, or in the country, I should say. And that is definitely not the case anymore. In fact, I believe there's only 5 active dairy farms now remaining in the county.
We're losing farmland basically in the urban areas, you know, as the cities grow, and there's, you know, just random development is mm-hmm. pushing the farms out further mm-hmm. and further and further. American Farmland Trust produced a report called Farmland Under Threat. Basically, they're saying that Wisconsin will lose 515,000 acres, most of that near the cities, Milwaukee and Madison, which I think we're kind of growing together, and 6,400 jobs by 2040. And the counties that are going to be hit the hardest are Waukesha, Dane, and St. Croix. That's why our work is so important, you know, to protect farmland, not only for the economy, for the state of Wisconsin. Farming and agriculture is a $100 billion-plus industry with 417,000 jobs, but also for food security and climate mitigation, like the things that Kyle was talking about with the best practices. Tall Pines is working together with American Farmland Trust, and we're trying to refund, meaning put funding back into the purchase of agricultural conservation easement program that the state used to have.
So back in 2011, the Working Lands Initiative was passed legislatively in the state of Wisconsin, which included a program called PACE, which is a purchase of agricultural conservation easements. And that program was targeted to protect farms in the urban perimeter that wanted to sell their development rights.
What does that program mean? Does it mean that X number of acres of your family land can never be developed?
Yes. So practically it means that our 237-acre home farm is under a conservation easement. The best way that I've ever had a conservation easement described to me is if you're a landowner and you look at your rights as a bundle of sticks. You have a stick that represents the right to hunt. You have a stick that represents the right to farm or the right to subdivide and sell. We took the right to subdivide or develop and sold that to Tall Pines and the state of Wisconsin in exchange for a designated dollar amount, which means that our farm now, that the parcels that we own can never be developed.
One of my favorite moments in my 16 years was when Joe Zwig stood up at a meeting and we had said, you know, somebody's got to step forward and do this program. And he stood up and he said, we'll go first. And
my dad was bolder than me.
And I'll never forget that. We need more farmers to step up wanting to protect their land, you know, to be perfectly frank. And then we need more land trusts who are willing to work with the farmers. Currently, there aren't many land trusts that do farmland protection in the state of Wisconsin. Tall Pines is regionally focused. They do most of their work in Waukesha, Washington, and Dodge. But we've got farmers that are coming to Tall Pines wanting to protect their land that are way out of those areas. Mm-hmm. And there's no other land trust to do it. So I'd like to see other land trusts step up to the plate and work with farmers, get that message out more.
How many farms in the Tall Pines area have followed suit? And what did you say the status of PACE is now?
So Tall Pines has approximately 2,200 acres of agricultural farmland protected. PACE was defunded by an administration at some point that I can't remember. But the program is still on the books, and we'd like to get that program refunded. But most of the work we've done with purchase of development rights has been through the AIL program, which is a federal program for agricultural land easement. We could do a lot more if we got the PACE program refunded at the state level, and we're working hard to have that happen. So we'd like to see $25 million put towards the PACE program, refunding the PACE program at the state level, and we can match that with federal dollars. There's a window of opportunity right now where there's a lot of federal dollars available, you know, like through IRA and those kind of programs. So we would have as much as, you know, $50 million, and we could protect, you know, quite a few farms. That would add $76 million to the Wisconsin economy. It would yield 500 new jobs, and it would protect 22,000 acres on 92 farms.
So this is something you're working on with fellow conservation groups?
We're specifically working on it with the American Farmland Trust, but there are six other land trusts and a couple of counties that are in this coalition that's pushing to get PACE refunded.
What are you going to be funneling your energy into, or you do not want to make any promises?
Refunding that PACE program.
I guess she's not going to stop.
No, I am very focused on that because I believe that it needs to happen. You know, agriculture is so important to the state. I just, you know, it really needs to happen. And now's the time because of what I said before, you know, the ability to match the federal dollars that are out there that hopefully will continue to be out there. You know, maintaining these dairy farms and maintaining farming is part of our culture here. We got to keep it.
Susan Buchanan was the executive director of Tall Pines for 17 years. She recently retired. You also heard from seventh generation farmer Kyle Zwig. They both spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. You may know John Gerda as a Milwaukee historian, but you probably didn't know he spent 32 years attempting to homestead in southwestern Wisconsin. In many ways, the experience was a disaster. So much of a disaster that at one point he started a fire that burned 130 acres. Yet Gerda still remembers the experience fondly and has taken a valuable lesson from the experience about his youthful hubris and nature's inevitability. Lake Effect Sam Woods speaks with Gerda about that experience.
Today, I want to talk to you about an article you wrote for Milwaukee Magazine called Driftless Dreams. Mm-hmm. And it's about your experience managing a plot of land in southwest Wisconsin for over 30 years. You know, read the article if you want the full story, right? But really quickly, what is the article about?
Basically, I've always considered myself a bi-coastal Wisconsinite.
Okay.
I was raised here in the shores of Lake Michigan in Milwaukee, but my mom was raised in a place called Coon Valley, Wisconsin, out mm-hmm. in the Driftless. So the Mississippi is kind of the other coast. And I've always had a real deep affection from the time I was probably in diapers, you know, mm-hmm. kind of going back to family reunions there. Certainly a lot of love for that area. And then the 1970s was a time when there was kind of a something resembling countercultural burnout, and there were a mm-hmm. lot of people kind of saying, all right, let's get out of here, you know, kind of leave the city. It was a back-to-the-land movement, and that's national. I saw it in, you know, California, all the way from California to Connecticut. And I began to think about kind of reclaiming some of the rural heritage, you know, from my mom's side of the family. Her dad's name was John Johnson from Wisconsin. He had a dairy farm on the hills above Coon Valley. So that was something I always, at the same time, you know, during those years, I was kind of reclaiming heritage and kind of going back to kind of what my roots were, and those included the land. So after a good deal of looking in 1975, my girlfriend, who became my wife, we bought 30 acres near a very small settlement called Bell Center, just a few miles south of Gays Mills off the Kickapoo River. And we had that for about 30 years through three kids and a lot of trials and errors. Mm-hmm. So it was very powerful episode in my life for all those years. And the first line in the story is, we made every mistake a city person could make. So it was, in a lot of ways, a lot of misadventures. But we grew and learned and changed, you know, as a result of those.
Yeah, and I do want to get into those misadventures because there's some fun stories there. Mm-hmm. But
not at the time.
Not fun to go through, but fun to look back of decades later. But take me back to 1975 and your mindset. What were you trying to create? What was the vision?
At that point, probably 5-6 years out of college, and working for a youth center on Milwaukee South Side, and just starting to do some of the kind of Milwaukee writing I've been doing for the last 50 years or so. But this was kind of an attempt to reclaim my sort of geographic and ethnic heritage, in the southwestern part of the state. And kind of the dream, if we had one, was to have this kind of alternative rural reality as kind of a counterpoint to life in the city. I love Milwaukee as well, but, there's a whole part of me that is quite non-urban, and sort of feeding that was kind of the vision. And couldn't afford to buy the place we finally found by myself. So a friend from high school, Mike Rimmer, he and I bought it together. And it still took us, it was $16,000. It took us 4 years to pay it off. So it was...
Good chunk of change.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
a little bit more in these days, I'm
sure. Right,
right. Yeah. Well, so now we get to the fun stuff, which is when reality sets in. And that kind of, that home away from home, or that oasis that you had in your mind, turns into... we'll say a project.
A whole lot of work.
Yeah. But in the article you mentioned wanting to have a vegetable garden, and there were some prairie lands that at the time the former owner's cow herd,
beef cattle,
were. They were there. they were there doing their thing. They were eating, eating the grass, eating, almost everything.
And depositing used grass on the
used grass. The land. Yes, a little fertilizer.
Right.
That didn't fit the vision at the time. At least their presence didn't fit the
vision. No, they were. They certainly did not much for the stream banks. No, they eroded the banks. And they actually, we had not been looking for a house, but there was a shack on the property, and there's an old portion that it was literally falling down. It was completely ruined. But there was a little 10 by 17 foot addition, so it was about the size of a suburban living room, and that was still there. The cows had gotten in, so there were smears of manure on the walls, so we
lovely.
We had a lot of cleanup
welcome
to do.
Welcome home. Welcome back.
So it was kind of the roof leaked, but we had not been expecting a roof, so that was fine. We could sort of fix it up as best we could. So we evicted the cows, and I still have a sharp memory of a friend, a neighbor, Bill Hutchison, helped us build the fence, put up the fence, and we kept one section open, and I recall being there, and we kind of herded these very large animals under the neighbor's property, the people we bought from, and feeling, finally, now it's just ours. And when we had first seen the place, it was a perfect park. It was grazed, so the one thing they did not eat was daisies. They're bitter for cows. So we saw that, I think, in June, and the whole property was covered with this waving field of daisies, so it really was pretty idyllic. Yeah. And we had a vision of continuing that kind of rural idyll out there, and the first thing we did was to plant a garden, and just very tough quack grass sod, sort of dig that up, a 30 by 30 foot plot. And what we were doing basically was opening a wound in the soil into which all these green germs poured, especially box elder trees, but a whole lot of weeds, a lot of invasive species. So, we're 3.5 hours away, so we weren't going to go out there at night, and weed and water. So we go out there the first year, probably every 2 or 3 weeks. So it was hard to keep up with, and eventually it was just completely overgrown. We planted trees, you know, which seems ironic at the time.
Yeah.
When you look back
in a wilderness,
in retrospect, yeah. Because the real basic mistake we made, put it in the story, was we failed to reckon with the awful fecundity of nature. Hmm. You know, it abhors a vacuum, and it was really filling in, you know, that vacuum. So we had forest on two sides, and very slowly but inexorably, well, you have these forest plants kind of coming in to what had been the pasture land where the cows were. The cows had been the equivalent of fire. No, they had kept the brush down. When they left, it was completely open season. Mm-hmm. So we had this dream of reforesting selectively, and what happened was it got reforested very unselectively.
Right. Nature has other plans. This one's forest everywhere.
Yep. Yeah. So it just, you know, it sort of came in and overwhelmed the shade, overwhelmed anything we tried to plant. And perhaps the most kind of ambitious project was putting prairie in the bottomland, about 3 acres of bottomland there. And the area floods periodically. It's just what the driftless does.
Yeah.
So you have seeds being washed out. You have trees coming in. The plants are kind of outcompeting. The prairie plants. So we tried to control it by fire. You know, that keeps the brush down. It worked well once. The second time it was a hot day in 1980, and we ended up burning 130 acres that weren't ours.
Yeah, that's quite a bit. That's a big is. Fire.
Went all the way up to the old Highway 61, and we got our notice in the Crawford County Independent. Mm-hmm. So it was not calculated to kind of win the Good Neighbor Award, you know,
in
Crawford County. And that thing kept on burning, you know, in some of the old deadwood, the old box elders. I remember being out there 2 or 3 weeks later, and there was still kind of, you look out at night, and there were still glowing embers in some mm-hmm. of the trees. So that was an unqualified disaster. So the word hubris comes to mind,
sure.
You know,
yeah.
And I think we went out there with the illusion that we could master this land, mm-hmm. and pretty much the opposite, you know,
yeah.
is what became the reality.
Well, and that's kind of what the, I guess a little bit of spoilers for the article, but it ends on that note of mm-hmm. of a what the limits that you can really do to, you know, tame nature, and even just
Absolutely.
Thinking in those terms of taming nature is just it's just folly.
Yep. Yeah, we're temporary. The
right.
land is permanent.
Yeah. Yep.
And what we do to it in our time can be it can be abusive, you know, it can be kind of ameliorative, it can help it, but we had this vision of remaking it in our own image, which was, you know, very much a matter of hubris. So it was a long learning lesson, you know, mm-hmm. in some ways, but useful as well. You know, it's kind of, you think Aldo Leopold, the land ethic, you think of it as something to which we belong instead of something that belongs to us.
Sure.
So we came out there saying, this is ours, mm-hmm. and you kind of, in the years that passed, you realize, you know, this is something that that has nature has a mind of its own, and you are well advised to cooperate with it, you know, and not try to master it.
Yeah. So you bought the land in 1975, and ended up selling it in 2007. So that's mm-hmm. that's 32 years
yep.
of adventures, we'll say,
right.
And lessons. And there's a lot of you talking about those lessons that you were just mentioning before about. You know, understanding what hubris looks like when it comes to, you know, relationships with nature.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit, just to end us on a note of how you think of that experience today?
Sure. You know, for more than 30 years, we had a front row seat at plant succession and how nature works. And one of the real high points there was we had 3 kids, and from the time they were in diapers to the time they were in high school, you know, that was a favorite place for them. So it really gave them a grounding in nature, and all 3 of them, you know, still look back on those years very fondly. Times when they could pretty much function independently. You know, you can't let them go. You try to stay away from rattlesnakes, but otherwise they were pretty much free to go where they wanted. So those were really treasured times, you know, for our family. But I think the larger lesson is the land itself was something that it was a lovely piece of property. Mm. And as I said in the article, there were times when the work was done, which was endless, and the kids were in bed where we didn't want to be any place else in the world. You know, that was just a fantastic place to be. Missteps and accidents and hubris aside, you know, it was a lovely place to have clear title to for 30 years. In time, you know, it did become, as the kids got older and busier, we got out there less and less, so we ended up selling that land and buying a smaller, much smaller and unmanaged piece of property up in the UP.
Let nature do its thing.
Let nature do its thing. It had its own ancient devices.
Yep.
We learned that lesson. Where we are now, there are wild blueberries, and we have no visions of planting anything more ambitious than that.
Well, John, thank you again for joining us on Lake Effect and talking to us about those driftless dreams.
My pleasure, Sam.
John Gerda is a writer and historian who has written 23 books on topics connected to Milwaukee and Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Sam Woods. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. In about 15 minutes, we'll learn about a mermaid teaching young people about environmental conservation through underwater performances. But first, we'll tell you about the local motorcycle racing scene that's featured in the documentary Angels of Dirt. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Wisconsin has an impressive motorcycle racing scene that has supported many riders from childhood into adult professional racers. One of those racers was West Dallas native Charlotte Keynes.
Here's my girl. She's finding the fast line and finding the jumps.
In the beginning, we were learning how to just ride a motorcycle, but we knew she wanted to race. We'd go out to Aslan, and she would be watching all the time, and she said, I want to get out there, I want to go do that. And her first race, she was really, really nervous. She was kind of scared, but she got through it and never looked back from there.
A documentary called Angels of Dirt shares the bruising, adrenaline-fueled world of flat-track racing. It explores Charlotte's life growing up on and off the track as she pursued her dream of being a professional racer. Shot over 17 years, the documentary draws from home movies, race footage, and interviews with Charlotte's friends and family to trace her quick rise in the sport, despite the barriers facing women. Angels of Dirt will be showing at the Time Cinema this Saturday. And director Wendy Schneider joins Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski to talk about the film.
Angels of Dirt is a documentary about Charlotte Keynes, who was raised around flat track racing and became a formidable professional racer herself. And you spent over 17 years on this project. So to start, I'm wondering what introduced you to the world of Wisconsin motorcycle racing to begin with.
Really, it was Aztalan Cycle Club. That's a racetrack in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. And I would drive to Milwaukee and I would see the track from the highway. And I started going to the track as a fan. And pretty soon after I noticed, you know, that there were a number of young girls racing motorcycles, I thought that it would be interesting to talk to a few of them about why they raced. So I showed up with a camera, and the first young racer I met was Charlotte Keynes.
How old was she when you met her?
She was 9 years old when I met her, drinking a Red Bull, getting ready to race.
Yeah, what stood out to you about her, outside of just that, you know, she was one of a few girls and a handful of boys racing?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually it. I mean, she was one of a handful of girls. She was tiny. She was quiet. And I think that the juxtaposition of motorcycle racing and a young, quiet, soft-spoken little girl who calls you Miss Wendy very politely as you chat with her was extraordinary to me. And I loved being able to lean in to how that felt when I first met her.
As a shy young girl, did it take a lot of convincing to let her know, like, hey, I think this is a great story. I want to film you. Was she open to that? Or I imagine she was like, well, maybe not.
Well, I think that originally I was very broad with my strokes with Angels of Dirt. I was just going to show up at this track. There was flat track racing on one weekend. Another weekend, there would be motocross racing, two very different communities, two very different styles of racing. And I was interviewing girls nonstop for about 3 years. Charlotte's family, I developed more of a connection with the family. And so there was just more depth in the work that I was doing with her. Did she want to be involved? Did I know what I was doing? You know, I think, yes, she wanted to be involved. Did I know what I was doing? Not really at that time.
So when did that moment happen for you, or a series of moments where it helped you solidify, this is my central theme for this documentary, to focus on Charlotte?
Well, the first era of Angels of Dirt is 2006, 7, and 8. And I knew that I had two different groups of racers in one very interesting environment. And so I was going to focus on the environment and the two camps. And there was a young girl, Charlotte, that was my focus for flat track. And there was a motocross racer named Kirsten Ramish, and she was my focus for motocross. And that's how it was going, with no real story, but I was following, and nobody was saying, go away. So the approach was just collect footage. And I did about 100 tapes of footage in those 3 years. In 2008, on my way to shoot footage of Kirsten Ramish, I was in a pretty bad car accident where there was loss of life. And that caused me to step away from the film. I took a year to do trauma therapy. I put Angels of Dirt on the shelf, and I had a really hard time going back to it. It felt unfocused. It felt wonderful in terms of the footage that I had, but it was very confusing to me how I was going to create a story. And then I started another project called The Smart Studio Story, which was about an independent recording studio in the Midwest. It was the next chapter of my life, was 6 years doing an independent doc about music. And almost to the day that that doc was released, when I came here to premiere it at the Oriental Theater in 2016, that was the same evening I did a condolence call because Charlotte had crashed racing professionally in Santa Rosa, California. I had not been following her for a number of years. We had loosely kept in touch, but it was a very intense crossroads for me as a filmmaker, because almost immediately I knew I was going to start Angels of Dirt again in an era two kind of approach and focus the film on the story of Charlotte Kanes.
The story of Charlotte also revolves around, as you said, Aztalan Cycle Club, also known as Azzy here. And it's almost a type of character in itself. So can you talk about what this place means to racers and what it meant to Charlotte?
You know, when people watch the film, I think they're exposed to this environment that is so homespun, that is so timeless, that is so, it's hard to really
I mean, it's kind of like how church festivals operate, but on a motorcycle track. You have the same people volunteering. You have a secretary for 30 plus years, like very homegrown.
Thank you. Yeah. That is absolutely perfect. And I loved that. You know, I come from instability. So anything that offers me stability, I'm sort of drawn to. And, you know, Azzy was just magnetic for me, from getting a beer and getting a brat to sitting on like the old wood bleachers that have been there for years and years. Everything just felt like it was being weathered along with all of us as we watch one of the oldest forms of motorcycle racing in the country, which is flat track. So I took to flat track more than I did to motocross. That's, you know, I can't lie. I felt more entertained, more at ease. There was more layers for me as a filmmaker to embrace Aztalan. I think the club started, oh gosh, in the 70s, the club started. Like, these racers needed a place to race. They literally got in a plane and, like, flew over areas of Wisconsin looking for where they could call home. They found a place. They leased it. They and Aztalan Cycle Club was built, and it's still operating today.
I love that. And this testament, you know, the fact that it's still around today is also a reflection of the people as well. So what stands out to you about the motorcycle racing community here as you've worked with them on and off over a decade plus?
Passion and devotion to each other, community. Community is a very strong energy in flat track, and I'm sure in motocross and other communities, but what I noticed in spending a lot of time in the flat track community, particularly picking the film up after we lost Charlotte, most of my interviews were about her or reflecting on the connection that people had to her, to community. And can I, you know, define exactly what that is? Not necessarily, but I know that Aztalan has created an environment that feels open and accepting to absolutely anybody that wants to participate.
There's a quote that stood out to me that a racer said about Charlotte, and they said, quote, "You wanted to stay behind her just to watch her ride." Yeah. You know, Charlotte was tough, she was fearless, yet, as you mentioned, shy. She seemed to let her racing speak for her. Like, she knew what she wanted to do.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She was just so determined to do it.
Yeah. I mean, this is a young woman who went as a child when she started to draw. She was drawing the motorcycle that she would race on the last day that she was here with us. You know, Charlotte manifested the life that she wanted, but she did it with parents who accepted and loved her and were gateways for her choices. These were all her choices. And to watch that, not only in Charlotte, but in so many young racers. And I was paying attention particularly to female racers because I'm a woman making a film and, you know, they are not necessarily an underdog, but they are a very small batch in professional racing. What I absolutely loved and respected about Flat Track is when I was shooting the film, there was no separation of male and female racers. It was strictly an ability sport, and I was drawn to that 100%. I really appreciated that about Azzy and Flat Track.
With indie filmmaking, you know, it's full of rewards, right? But also many challenges. It's very much a labor of love. So can you share some of the challenges that stand out to you the most about bringing Angels of Dirt to completion to an audience today?
Yeah, the challenge was there's the nuts and bolts about financing, right? You always have to. If you want help, you're usually hiring people. Or to sustain a film like Angels of Dirt, you know, you need capital. And so I did a fair amount of fundraising for the film, which is not my – it becomes your strong suit because you have to do it and you're passionate about the project. But it's not what I would choose to do. This film really had me wrestling with how to tell a story like this, how to incorporate footage that was shot when I was making one film and have it woven into a film that was really a very different focus. And that was loss. And also how to really challenge an audience or make available this opportunity for an audience to lean into this story and make connections for themselves with regard to love and loss and community and how expansive life can be when we lose someone. You know, telling that story with Angels was very challenging for me, along with keeping an audience that has nothing to do with motorcycle racing engaged. You know, so I have to give components of what is the history of this sport and who are some of the players in it, who are some of the women in it. You don't see full-length documentaries about motorcycle racers who are women from the 70s, from the 80s. They just don't exist. Short profile films do, of course they do, but that's marketing.
Yeah. Right. With the many roles you've played for this documentary, you also wrote the score. So I'm wondering, how did it feel taking a composer's stance and like making you connect with this material in a different way? You know, it's like you have your editing lens on, you're doing that, but yeah. Like, okay, I need to take a step back. And what music is coming to me that I feel connects with this footage?
The music for the film was done throughout the editing process. Sometimes I would be playing something and know that it might work for a certain section of the film, or I was writing music and then I'd put it into the film and know I had to change it because the edit was changing a little bit, or the emotion was changing. You know, I come from a musical background. I've been in bands. I'm a musician and recording engineer myself. And part of my schooling when I was in my early 20s was providing underscore to content. And so I think developing an emotional thread for the film using music was really how I was going to contribute my voice to the movie. I knew that I could do it. I knew what the emotion was for what I was trying to share in terms of the message of a scene or of a chapter of the film. And so it was challenging, but I really enjoy, you know, I've been asked, like, why didn't you play a role in this movie? Why didn't you interview yourself? Or where are you in this film? And I'm in the music.
So we talked a bit about the challenges, but how about the triumphs?
you know, I showed the film recently to a large audience, and when people cheer for Charlotte racing, or they weep when she's gone, or moments of the film where there's laughter, weeping, enthusiasm, those are amazing experiences for me to go through, because it has been such a private and isolating experience for all these years. Even when people come in and help, I know that ultimately I've had to finish it. That's been very challenging for me on personal levels, mm-hmm. and energetically, and on my heart, my head. I mean, everything is involved. But to have the film received, and to have the story of Charlotte and other women and flat track racing go out into the world and be received in a way that feels really organic and fun and thrilling, and I don't know, I think that that's remarkable for me.
Well, thank you for coming in today to share more about this 17-year labor of love. I was very glad to watch it, and I'm sure other people in Milwaukee will be as well.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Wendy Schneider is the screenwriter, producer, and director of the documentary Angels of Dirt. It'll be showing at the Time Cinema this Saturday evening as part of a fundraiser to benefit Build Moto Mentor Program. Schneider will be in attendance for a Q&A. The conversation you just heard with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski first aired last spring when the documentary was in the Milwaukee Film Fest. You can find more information at WUWM.com. After a short break, we'll meet someone who teaches environmental conservation by performing as a mermaid. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Have you ever wanted to meet a mermaid? Echo is a UWM graduate and project manager for coastal resiliency who performs as Mermaid Echo. Mermaiding is wearing or swimming in a mermaid tail, and Echo has been doing that for over a decade, all in the name of educating young people. Lake Effect's Excret Nunez spoke with Echo about their passion for environmental conservation.
I've been following your work as Mermaid Echo for a while now, and something that's stood out to me is your passion for freshwater conservation. Where does your passion stem from?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think that I was inspired to care about freshwater ecosystems ever since I was a kid. I grew up on the St. Croix River, and it was a beautiful ecosystem, but of course it was kind of undermanaged, and so we'd often take our boat. We are very privileged to have access to boats. We'd take our boat out on the river and find trash in the water. And I remember trying to stay underwater for as long as I could to look at all the fish, and I'd be sad when I find like a piece of trash under there, and I'd bring it up and make little piles of trash on the boat deck. And for some reason, that's a core memory. And so since I was a kid, I, whether consciously or subconsciously, have been, I guess, trying to find a pathway in life that would put me around water as much as possible. And now we're here. I think I'm closer now than I have been ever before, which is really, really exciting.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I guess, did this passion for freshwater conservation have anything to do with your decision to pursue mermaiding? Is that even
no,
the right term?
No, mermaiding came first, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, so I think I've always cared about the water, but I was, you know, as a kid, like, ignorant to how much of an issue we are facing in the climate crisis in regards to freshwater access and preservation. Obviously, I didn't have any of that language, you know, as a five-year-old. But the reason why I started mermaiding was I had surgery on my ankle, and then I had to recover from that, and I did that through swimming. And one way you can, like, strengthen your, you know, injured limb is by attaching it to another one. So if you break a finger, you tape two together. You know, same thing happens for feet. So I would swim with a monofin where both of your feet are in one fin, and that would help strengthen the weak one. And eventually I found a tail skin that went over the monofin and up to your waist like a skirt, and it looked like a mermaid tail. And on that same website, I found that tail. My first tail, I found a website. It's basically Facebook for mermaids. It was called themernetwork.com, now kind of defunct. But on there, I saw that people were using mermaiding as an avenue to educate kids about conservation, and instantly I was like, well, I'm starting a business. I'm 16, but I'm doing it, you know. I had no idea what I was doing or what I was getting myself into, but I just the idea just like clicked with something very integral, I think, to who I am and what I love. But when I was in high school, I was very, very bad at math and science, and my teachers were always pulling me in after class, you know, saying we need to sit down one-on-one and work on this stuff, and I was just mortified. And then I couldn't deny the fact that I wanted to be telling more people about freshwater ecosystems. And so I said, as a joke, I'm not smart enough to be a scientist, so I will become a mermaid, because that is one avenue in which I can teach kids about the water, in which I don't have to have, you know, this crazy scientific background. I only have to know basic, you know, education principles and outreach principles that I can teach kids. That worked well for a while until I started doing it much more professionally, and I learned that there is so much I didn't know. But I just kept having this bug and this itch to get into science and really learn the nitty-gritty behind, you know, why is there only 4% of research done on freshwater ecosystems when everything else is done on marine ecosystems, when freshwater is our vital resource for survival? And now I get to say that, you know, I told myself I couldn't be a scientist, but I was wrong. Now I'm a scientist and a mermaid. So that's the full story of where I came from and why.
That's pretty amazing. Like, you proved yourself, I guess, to other people, but to yourself, too, that you're able to do this. Why is it important to you to educate young people about caring for our freshwater systems specifically?
Oh my God, thank you for this question. Yes, amazing. Yes. Okay, so this, I'm gonna get on my soapbox a little bit. We're gonna talk about why we need to be putting conservation education into the hands of young kids also. Yes, we need to talk to policymakers. Yes, we need to talk to corporations. Yes, you can do your part to like not use a plastic straw and use reusable water bottles. Great, wonderful, love it. That means nothing if the next generation doesn't also know about this stuff. If the next generation is not brought on board to this party we're having, it's going to go all in the trash, all of our hard work. So let's do all of that, but let's also bring kids into the conversation, because we know that the climate crisis most negatively affects marginalized communities, you know, BIPOC, trans kids, lower income communities. And we also know that conservation education, historically, at least based on the research I know, is delivered only to more affluent neighborhoods, right? We're talking the nature preschools, and private schools have often conservation curriculum. Public schools do not, you know, and often it is the first to be removed if we have extra time for it at all. And so that's a problem. And in order to continue to have a world that we can live in, we need to know how to prevent climate degradation from getting exorbitantly worse. And so I think that by investing in edutainment, or at least conservation education, at the K-12 level, we are really doing preventative measures to make sure that the hard work we're doing now in policy will be preserved. We need to ensure that our futures are going to be okay by providing access to this kind of stuff to the kids who it will be affecting the most and who don't have access to it right now. So that's my soapbox. That's why I'm doing all this.
Yeah. Wow. And what's the biggest takeaway you hope young people leave with after your performances or class lesson?
I hope kids take away the knowledge that they can make a difference. And so I have this little pledge that I do at every single event I've ever done. I wrote it when I was 17, launching my business, and it hasn't changed. And kids that come to shows take that pledge, and it basically says that they can make a difference just by being themselves and committing to learn about this stuff and to tell other people. That's really what it's all about. You have the power to make change just by talking to people. You don't even have to make a huge habitual change in the way you live your life, but just tell people, like, just talk about it. You know, somebody out there has the resources to make big substantial change across corporations and policymakers. Great. Just talk to them. You know, it's not all on your shoulders, and working together can really make a big difference. And I think kids often in the topic of conservation are scared. You know, it is a scary topic, but if we say to kids, like, you have the power to be the change maker that will save our Great Lakes. There's a really empowering message there that isn't scary, is accessible, and also gives them agency. So inspiring them is the way to go, I think.
My last question to you, I've read that you'll be graduating this December.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll continue your work as Mermaid Echo after you graduate?
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. I've been speaking with a couple of clients about procuring different sort of bigger moves in my field. This is so vague. I hate it when people do this, but I have to do it. About different bigger moves and different plans, and that they're all very, very exciting, and they're definitely moving in the direction of where I want to go, which is so exciting for me. So I cannot wait to see those come to fruition so I can share with you and with everybody what they are. But they're all surrounding the idea of just bringing more conservation education into the hands of the people who need it the most, whether that's through public performance art or private appearances, whether at birthday parties or elsewhere. I'm very excited about all of those opportunities. So yeah, I don't foresee me not being a mermaid anymore anytime soon. I'll probably be in a wheelchair and then still like jump in the lake with my little tail and try to swim around. So when I'm 85 or something.
Big moves on the horizon.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Good.
I'm excited.
Well, Echo, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah.
It was great to learn more about you and your work.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. It was a joy.
Echo is a creative educator who teaches about freshwater conservation through their underwater performances as Mermaid Echo. They spoke with Lake Effect's Excret Nunez in 2023. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about a local surfer developing an innovative, sustainable surfboard. Thank you so much for joining us right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.